With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Hello and welcome to Seriously, the New Statesman podcast that takes pop culture seriously.
I'm Caroline Crampton.
And I'm Anna Leskovich. This week, we're talking about the new Arctic Monkeys album, Tranquility Base Hotel and Casino, and the fourth series of the Scandinavian crime drama, The Bridge.
We've also been playing the mobile game Harry Potter Hogwarts Mystery for the first time, so we'll be talking about how that went later in the show.
Hello, and welcome back to Seriously. It's a Monday when we're recording this. You're probably listening to it on a Tuesday or maybe even later. But we woke up to some great news, which is This Country, one of our favourite shows, won two BAFTAs at the BAFTA TV Awards last night, which is very exciting and meant that it was tied as the best show. Basically, it picked up to the same number as Three Girls. So what an achievement.
Yeah, I was so happy to see that. I saw like a little bit on Twitter before I went to bed last night and then like properly woke up this morning and read all of the coverage of it. And also Daisy May Cooper was wearing an absolutely incredible outfit.
A blinder of a dress.
She was wearing a kind of floaty red silk caftan, but that was kind of modelled on a football shirt.
Yeah, it's like the Swindon Football Club colours, which is hilarious. And Swindon FC get a couple of shout outs in the show. Basically, Daisy's dad in the show, Martin Mucklow, father of Kerry, loves Swindon. Yeah, it's really, really funny. And the best bit was the shoes that were sort of looked like football socks.
Yes, it was incredible. Yeah, I saw Caitlin Moran posting an Instagram of the two of them together. And the caption was like, you know, really love this woman. She's achieved so much. And then also a quote from Daisy May. It was like, I've just seen I've made the Daily Mail's worst dress list. Life goal achieved.
That's so great. Yeah, then I also thought it was pretty outrageous that she went in this crazy outfit and Charlie just went in a suit.
Yeah,
looking great.
Just normal. Just standard stuff.
But yeah. Fine.
Two great Seriously faves did well at the BAFTAs. This Country, which you can go back and listen to us talking about. And then also Three Girls, which we also thought was incredible. I'm really glad to see that rewarded because it was, if you didn't catch it, it was a one-off drama about the Rotherham grooming case, basically. Like a dramatised story based on the true incidents. And I think it did a lot to help more people realize the total horror of what happened.
And also how ill-equipped our police force were before then and how much has changed since then, which is really interesting. Yeah, so great. Amazing scenes at the BAFTAs. So rolling on with the show, the first thing that we're going to talk about this week, I'm very excited, is Tranquility Base Hotel and Casino, the sixth studio album from Sheffield indie rock band Arctic Monkeys. It's a major departure from their previous musical styles and takes the form of a concept album about a futuristic moon colony, told through songs inflected with jazz and lounge pop. It was written by band frontman Alex Turner on an upright piano and is heavily influenced by retrofuturism and 1970s groups like the Walker Brothers. So yeah, this is album number six from Arctic Monkeys. I've been a real Arctic Monkeys fan since album number one, followed them all throughout school as everyone did at my age. I think probably my interest in them peaked around Humbug, Suck It and See and AM. And I've seen them play live lots of times at different music festivals and things. So this is 5 years after their fifth album was released. So it's, in a way, it's almost as long between albums 5 and 6 as albums 1 and 5.
Yeah.
So they did an album almost every year for 7 years or something. And now they've had such a long gap. And that's partly because Alex Turner's been doing other projects with The Last Shadow Puppets and things. And I guess partly because they just, it takes time to make an album and it takes time to develop a new idea.
Yeah. And especially when you've, you know, attained the sort of heights that they have, both critically and commercially, there's both the pressure off in the sense that you don't need to like immediately tour a new album to make money, but also the pressure is very much on because whatever you put out, people are going to like review and pull apart and critique. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I have a slightly different relationship with the Arctic Monkeys to Anna, which was that their first album came out when I was like just finishing school, and it absolutely hit peak Caroline interest in indie rock music. So I was like dead into them for about 18 months, saw them at loads of festivals, like went to loads of gigs. And then my indie rock music obsessive phase faded quite quickly. And so I haven't heard, I haven't knowingly heard any Arctic Monkeys albums since that first one until I listened to this one. I mean, I'm sure I have like heard some of their songs, but I couldn't tell you what they are.
It must seem an even bigger departure for you then, because I feel like every album that they release, people are like, wait, what? This isn't like the Arctic Monkeys. Okay. But I agree that this is the biggest leap in that sense, because their last album was very greasy, guitar heavy, retro influenced rock music. And it was all big kind of anthemic songs that you could play to a sold out O2 arena or whatever. With, you know, the mosh pit going crazy. This isn't like that at all. There's a line in it where he says, I've played to quiet rooms before. And I read an interview, I think in NME, where someone said, oh, that's an interesting line, because, and Alex Turner was like, oh yeah, our rooms might be a lot quieter now if we're making music like this. It's true. So yeah, it's more of a kind of sit down listen than a go wild listen.
Yeah, I absolutely love it though. I've like had it on repeat all weekend, and I just think it's brilliant. I mean, it could be by a totally different band, given that I'm referring back to, you know, the like whatever people say
that's what I'm not
era, which was all about like going on nights out with your mates and like getting in fights with the bouncer and being in cabs on the way home and all that kind of stuff.
But now they're like 35 and living in LA, and they've been professional musicians for over a decade. So it'd be a bit weird if they were still singing about like just swapping t-shirts to get past the bouncer.
Yes, exactly. And in a way, I have a lot of respect for that, because I think there are bands that do carry on trying to do that because it's, you know, what made them successful. It's what people know and it's what people want to hear. Whereas I think people who like visibly develop as artists in their public output, that's much more honest. Also, I know you wrote a really great piece on the New Statesman website about this last week. It's a real risk to just be like, now we shall do a concept album about a moon colony.
Yeah, it kind of reminded me of, I think we said this about Hamilton, that if Lin-Manuel Miranda came to you before he was famous and was like, yeah, I've got this amazing idea for like a hip hop concept album about, you know, one of the founding fathers, but he's like kind of a neglected one, but I read this biography and I thought it was really cool, so I'm going to make a concept album about it, but it's rap and it's hip hop. You'd be like, that idea should never see the light of day, my friend. Just going to give you some advice. Like, don't pursue that. That is so embarrassing. And that's what this album is like in theory as well. It's just like, what are you doing? This is so, especially because there's a vein to it, which is a little bit scornful of like smartphones and social media. And that is specifically designed to make me vom, I think. That kind of like, put down your phone, love. There's a world outside kind of vibe, which will always and forever remind me of Owen Quigg's song about putting your phone away, who was a X Factor reject in like 2007 or something. But yeah, it's not embarrassing when you actually listen to it. It's actually quite interesting and cool and really good, even though the idea sounds bonkers.
Yeah. And separately also, I don't know so much about like the history of classic man music, but I do feel like there is a well-trodden path with particularly male artists in sort of mid-career to be like, now I shall make my space album.
Yeah, I know. Totally.
There's obviously like the Bowie example, but I feel like lots of bands do this. Mm. They're like, now the outer space music.
Like Elton John's Rocket yeah. Man. And both of them using it as like a metaphor for fame being isolating.
Yeah.
It's like cool and exciting to be in space, but you're also on your own. That's kind
and of... And that's it. That's the extent of the metaphor. Yeah.
Yeah, basically. Yeah.
So when I... Because I didn't really read much, obviously not being like a huge Arctic Monkeys fan, I didn't read much of the like build-up press around this. Mm. I was just aware that it was coming out. So then when I like literally saw the artwork as I was loading up, I was like, oh God, no, this is their like space album.
Yeah, yeah.
But then...
And that is what this is.
It is, but it's brilliant because it's wry and it's quite self-aware, and also just musically I think it's beautiful.
Yeah, I really love the tone of it, which is kind of veers between sincerity and like absolute detached self-deprecating irony. And I think there are some really funny lines in it, and there when I listened to it the first time there are a couple of lines where I was like, oh okay, that's actually really funny. I really liked the line, dance like somebody's watching because they are, which is in a song that is a bit sort of like, oh, everyone's obsessed with social media. But I just thought that was a funny line. And kiss me under the moon's side boob.
Yes, I loved that bit.
So there's all these kind of one-liner jokes in there that are really good. And there's like a broader sense of self-deprecation as well, with this kind of repeated portrait of a very long-haired, embarrassing, heavily moustached 1970s washed up rock star. And I think that's Alex Turner making a joke out of himself and his various personas, because he kind of went through a kind of shaggy hippie long haired phase in the in the Humbug album 3 era, and also a kind of slicked back 1950s over the top leather jacketed rocker in his last album. So I think he's kind of amalgamating those personas and being like, yeah, obviously this is a bit cringe in different ways. And yeah, I really enjoy that kind of tone in the album.
Yeah, I'm really interested as well to see how it fits in the dialogue of like guitar music at the moment, because I do think that there are a lot of bands who want to be the Arctic Monkeys even now. Mm. And I wonder whether this will maybe like free some of, like the 1975, for instance, like will this kind of free them up to stop being such dicks all the time?
I don't know, but I like that this is sort of not guitar music, which is really the boldest thing they could have done, because over all their 5 albums, although the styles have changed and the tones have changed, it's always been dominated by guitar riffs, like, and this just isn't. Like, obviously there's plenty of guitar in there, but it's never the dominant force on a song. It's always, the melodies are really like vocals and pianos, and the, you know, there's quite a lot of kind of jazzy bass in this, but not that much kind of lead guitar, you know, elaborate stuff, which yeah, is a real risk for them, but I really like it. And it's funny because I think it almost sometimes for me feels like Alex Turner and the band are struggling with this idea that they would put down the guitars and move to piano. So there's the last track on the album is called The Ultra Cheese, and it really dials up the piano to this kind of like karaoke Billy Joel, Frank Sinatra, Great American Songbook style love song, but it's overdoing it on purpose, as if to be like, obviously we know like piano ballads are embarrassing, but we're gonna like
and it's called The Ultra Cheese. Yeah,
exactly. So we're going to make it ultra cheesy as though we're all in on the joke. But it's still ultimately a cheesy but beautiful love song on the piano. So it's kind of having its cake and eating it in this weird way. And I quite like, there's just a level of personality there, which I quite like and find quite funny. So Yeah,
I think it's great. And I really, really hope that it's already been something of a critical success, I think. Just the first reviews have all been like, wait, what? No, I really like this.
Apart from Rolling Stone, who gave it 2 stars.
Yeah.
Which also I'm like, it's quite brave, because I feel like a lot of reviewers probably didn't like this album but felt too afraid to say they didn't like it.
Yeah,
so they've been like, it's weird but interesting. Maybe that's unfair, but I liked that at least someone was like, nah, it's rubbish, mate.
Yeah.
Even though I liked it.
As a side note, I guess I'm way more conscious of this stuff now than when I was, like, when I was 17 and, like, scouring for reviews of their first album, that almost no women get to review the Arctic Monkeys.
Yeah.
Like, there've been a couple, like, the only one I've managed to find, I'm sure maybe there are more, but Roisin O'Connor reviewed it for The Independent, but... Mm. I can't find any others. And even just like I was reading the Pitchfork review, and their site is very good at helping you find other related content at the bottom. It had all the reviews for all of their other albums, and they were all by men as well.
Yeah, Pitchfork really struggles with the gender divide, I think. But anyway, Kate Mossman's reviewing it for the New Statesman out this week, so pick that up. Yeah, really worth a listen, I think.
Definitely.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Now we're going to talk about The Bridge, which is a Scandinavian noir crime series made jointly by the Danish and Swedish public broadcasters. Each series to date, this is the fourth one, focuses on a murder investigation that somehow involves the 5-mile bridge between Copenhagen and Malmö, thereby necessitating a joint investigation by the two cities' detectives. Sofia Helen stars as the Swedish police officer Sagan Oren, and in the fourth series, she's joined by Danish partner Henrik Sabro, who's played by Tore Lindhardt, to investigate the killing of the Danish immigration minister.
Yeah, so season 4 came to the BBC this week. It's already been released in Denmark and Sweden, Caroline tells me. I'm just parroting what she just told me. The cold open before the credit sequence is a quite grim murder scene of this immigration minister. And, you know, she's blonde, pretty, middle-aged woman, and it's just quite grim to watch, and it feels like part of a pattern in crime. And there's been lots of talk about this recently, actually, haven't there? Because Jermaine Greer said some things about how, you know, the body count on of violence against women on TV is just like absolutely insane, which is obviously true. But yeah, that was an interesting opening scene for me. And then you get the main episode after the credit sequence, which isn't so grim to watch at all, but it's just a very shocking way to introduce you to the series.
Yeah, and so The Bridge is, as I'm sure people know, part of this broader trend, I feel like, from the early, like, 2010s onwards, of Scandinavian, quite dark, thriller, detective-y TV shows that have been super popular and exported all around the world. I think The Killing was probably the one that really set it off. There were then three series of that, but we've had The Bridge and lots of others. Borgen was slightly different in that it was a kind of political drama, but it was still Danish and subtitled. And it was just like suddenly this realization that there was this whole audience of people in English language countries who were happy to watch things with subtitles in a way that broadcasters maybe hadn't appreciated before. But the common thread between all of them is this quite graphic depiction of violence against women. And I don't know, I really struggle with it because it is such a visual meme on television. It's everywhere. It's often really, at least in this case, it's a little bit like, you know, we actually saw her face and we're hearing about her life afterwards. Quite often it's just a kind of like, dump the body, never mention the person again, you know, almost like a plot device for the story with no character context.
There's a way that it can be done well, obviously. And I've been really enjoying, which I think we will talk about on Seriously in detail when it's available to watch in the UK. I've been really enjoying Killing Eve, in which there are some really grim scenes of murder where a woman is, you know, being killed in a really unpleasant way. But because of the wider context of the show, I don't mean the media narrative around it, but when you're watching it, the wider context within the show is done, handled in such a way that you don't, it doesn't feel gross, it doesn't feel exploitative, it doesn't feel, it's just tonally, it's kind of fine. And I think sometimes in these quote grittier shows, it actually feels kind of worse to me, because it feels more like it's being done to try and signal that this is like a serious prestige gritty show,
yeah,
more than it is because it serves plot, as you say.
Yeah, definitely. There is, against all of this though, always this little voice in my head which is like, but men do murder
all day, every
women
day.
Like,
yeah.
all day every day. So whilst I'm not saying that, you know, it's nice to watch it or necessarily like always a good artistic decision,
it's the reality.
There is always part of me that's like, well, it's not unrealistic.
Yeah, exactly. So it's a tricky question.
Yeah. And I feel like I'm constantly having a conversation with myself whenever I watch things like this, mm-hmm, about whether I should be enjoying it or mm-hmm not.
And one of the show, so anyway, one of the reasons why The Bridge in particular has been such a successful or critically acclaimed show has a lot to do with its lead character of Saga, mm-hmm, who is, you know, a nuanced and interesting portrait of a woman that isn't one that we've seen a lot, I don't think, on TV. Like, there's an argument that she could fall into this kind of stereotype of like antisocial, almost masculine woman, workaholic figure. But I think she's actually more interesting than that and is more detailed than that. So this show, if we're talking about it through a feminist lens, it has lots to give as well.
Yeah. And so I think this show's followed the pattern of lots of these things in that this is now its fourth series. And I think they've said it's going to be its last, although I'm not 100% on that. And each series comprises like one investigation, but the character arcs of the recurring roles do continue across multiple series. So for instance, in this first episode, which we've just watched, Saga she starts out in prison because of the events of series three. And she's awaiting the result of a retrial that might mean that she's released. To be honest, a whole lot of it still harks back to what happened in series one, which was the kind of iconic one that really went
around the world,
this body was found halfway across the bridge between Denmark and Sweden. And that's how Saga and her original Danish partner, Martin, ended up working together in the first place.
Which was really harrowing, actually. And I think that part of why I stopped watching The Bridge was because there was a sort of final episode twist that was so horrific,
horrible,
that I was like, afterwards I felt grief, I felt gutted. It was just so, what they do to characters that you know and love and like, it's just so unthinkable in most shows. You're like, well, they wouldn't do that, that would just be too dark and too terrible, and then they do it. So I found it too exhausting to carry on with The Bridge, but I was skeptical. Caroline sort of said before we watched this, like, oh, you should be fine going into season four, episode one. You should know what's going on. And I was kind of like, will I? I don't know if I will, because I haven't seen a lot of it. And actually, although, as you say, there's kind of two plot lines, and the case plot line, totally perfectly, it is quite accessible, actually, from if you haven't seen the other seasons. Obviously, the backstory with Saga, why she's in prison, is a little bit trickier to follow, but they do spell it out for a new viewer as well. It's a shame if you then want to go back, because obviously it does spoil the events of season three, but it is quite accessible. I think it's quite clearly spelled out.
Yeah, and I'm intrigued as well by, I think The Bridge, of all of the Scandi noir things that I've seen, does the most to try and keep its like police context topical. So as we said, the murder that they start off investigating in this series is of the Danish immigration minister. And there's already, just having seen one, we're seeing the kind of context around the fact that Denmark's quite draconian immigration policy in the wake of the Syrian refugee crisis and stuff has been really controversial with some people. Immediately, the detectives are like, well, there was this viral video of people in the Danish immigration department celebrating with champagne a successful deportation. And the minister was like really under fire for this. So you get this kind of political context that doesn't feel that far off what we're experiencing in the UK at the moment, with the way the Home Office has handled the Windrush and stuff and hostile environment and all of that, you know. And in previous series, it's focused on stuff like eco-terrorism and things like that. So I feel like they do try and root it in vaguely believable scenarios.
We're already getting all these themes of like, yeah, immigration, Islamophobia, homophobia, like police kind of resistance to, I don't want to say political correctness, because that's not actually the right phrase, just like sensitivity and ethics. You know, there's a kind of horrible character who's often using slurs at work and stuff. So that's interesting. But yeah, I agree with you. I think it's really topical. And I sort of want to say, like, shout out to public broadcasters, because all the shows that we've referenced today, from This Country to Three Girls to The Bridge, are like public broadcaster made shows. Mm. And I feel like there's a level of authenticity to all three that's, you know, they span genres and locations in this like extremely broad way, but they're all like rooted in something very, very real. And I think because public broadcasters have a obligation to reflect the lives of their viewers in some way, it often ends up with you just having a level of authenticity that's quite hard to put a finger on, but does make stuff really, really good.
Yeah, but I feel like you can see it, or rather you can see the lack of it, when these shows get remade by non-public broadcasters, because that's also been part of this like Scandi Noir popularity trend, is that like The Killing got remade in the US, although obviously it wasn't Scandi Noir. I feel like it was heavily influenced by Broadchurch, got remade in the US. I think The Bridge did as well.
Yeah.
I never watched it.
And things like the American film of The Snowman, the Joe Nesbo, which was absolutely panned. Like a lot of these Americanizations just get completely, they lose something. And I'm watching Scum Austin at the moment, which is the American remake of Scum, the Norwegian show also made by a public broadcaster, NRK. And it's just lost something totally. And it's interesting. I mean, I can't quite put my finger on it. And I'm, you know, I might be stretching a little, but for me it feels like there's a real connection in how authentic all these shows are.
Yeah, I'm similarly, I can tell when it's not there, but I can't quite explain what it is. I don't know, maybe it's low budget or something like that. But anyway, yeah, so I have followed The Bridge through seasons 2 and 3, partly because my parents are really into it. And this is something that I wanted to mention, is in Britain, the like Scandi Noir fandom is very interesting, I think, because I think it is predominantly slightly older people, so like 30s upwards, or not to say that there aren't younger people who like it too, but it's definitely like a BBC 4 audience, let's call it. And so in about 2012, I think, when The Killing was like just at its peak and The Bridge had just started and all of this, I went to cover this like fan festival in East London for these TV shows, which was one of the strangest events I've ever been to in my whole life, where they'd taken this big old derelict brewery in just off Brick Lane and like partitioned it all off with big black curtains, and they'd flown all the stars of these shows over to the UK for the weekend, and there were screenings of new episodes and in conversations with writers and directors and actors. But because they'd done it all like super on the cheap, everyone had to wear silent disco headphones and like tune into the correct channel for the event they were in, because otherwise you could just hear every event all the way through this massive warehouse.
That's so weird.
And I found it so interesting that all of the actors who were there, particularly the actors, were just so politely baffled at the way people were treating them. I'm thinking particularly the woman who plays the main character in Borgen, who I think is actually like a sort of major Danish thespian. You know, she's sort of like Judi Dench level in Denmark, primarily known for her like amazing Shakespearean performances and stuff. And here she is like suddenly famous in the UK for some random crime drama that she did probably like in 3 months for the money. So yeah, it was so interesting. And so many people in like jumpers being a big part of liking these shows and all of this. It's the first time I'd ever experienced like what I would call a kind of classic fan response, but from middle-aged white people.
That's so funny. I feel like it's not really showing any signs of slowing down, even if The Bridge is entering its final season. There's just still so much of it that my mum is a big watcher of these kinds of shows. So you're right about the age group, I think.
Yeah, and they are, I think, well-written, tightly plotted, often with really interesting, good cinematography as well. Like the original, I think it's Swedish series of Wallander, the one that they remade with Kenneth Branagh in the English version, had some incredible like nature shots in it and all of that. So I think within the genre of like dark thriller stuff, they are doing interesting things. They're not churning it out by numbers, which maybe would have been the temptation when all the syndication money started rolling in. So yeah, I continue to be impressed by what they're doing, and I'm going to keep watching this series. It's got the first episode has got quite a major cliffhanger at the end of it. Although you said that the BBC trailer completely
spoils really undermines
it.
the cliffhanger ending of episode one. But you know, whatever, you gotta get your cliffhangers where you can, don't you?
Yeah.
So last week we decided to play Harry Potter Hogwarts Mystery, which is a new game from, is it from Pottermore? It's like an official Harry Potter game.
It's an official Harry Potter game. Yeah. When you start it, like the Warner Brothers logo and loads of stuff comes up. So yeah, it's very sanctioned. It's part of
it's from
the
Port
commercial
Key
universe.
Games is the, and Warner Brothers. So I guess Portkey okay. Games is the Harry Potter games producers. You're basically a student and you enroll in Hogwarts, and the mystery element kind of is in the back seat when you start playing, in that you're just like getting on with your Hogwarts life, and then you're sort of vaguely aware underneath it all that the character that you've kind of come up with, I assume this is the same in every version of the game, though. Yeah, I don't know for 100%.
I think so.
The brother of your character is involved in something shady and has went missing, and you're kind of keen on, obviously, finding the whereabouts of your brother. Yeah, but it starts off with kind of all the classic stuff that you want from any sort of Harry Potter extra material, which is like you can go to Diagon Alley and pick up your school stuff, and you can get sorted into the house you want to get sorted into, and you can like design, you know, what kind of haircut you have. It's like almost a bit Simsy at the start.
Yeah, it does let you modify your character's appearance mm-hmm. and give them a name and all of that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And then you sort of play through a Hogwarts year.
Yeah.
Essentially, you go to lessons, you learn spells, you interact with other students, mm-hmm. you like earn house points, mm-hmm. you lose house points, mm-hmm. et cetera, et cetera. It is set, I think, sort of between the two Wizarding Wars, in the sense that like Harry Potter doesn't exist yet, but Voldemort does. Mm-hmm. So my guess is that it's like in the period,
the 80s.
Obviously Harry Potter does exist, but like it's in the period when Harry is like a child still living right. at the Dursleys. Voldemort has been quote defeated mm-hmm. and everyone thinks everything is fine again. Again, it's hard to tell whether it's the same for everyone when you play it, because mm-hmm. obviously the game like changes itself based on the choices you make mm-hmm. and the responses that you give to things. But I think you're kind of like an avatar for a Harry-like character mm-hmm. in, say, Philosopher's Stone, because you do quite a lot of, you know, going out of bounds to try and find things out about your brother. You have a bookish friend who's a bit yeah. like Hermione.
Yeah. Who knows everything about the wizarding world and can conveniently yeah. tell you things that you don't know.
In my version as well, I seem to have got a Neville as well now.
Yeah. Yeah.
Someone called Ben, who is scared of everything, but like secretly really good at charms. Mm-hmm. So there are a lot of similarities, although obviously it's supposed to be a kind of self-insert thing. You're supposed to like think of yourself as the character that you're playing.
Yeah. One thing that kind of disappointed me is that when you get some choices, it says like, which would you like to happen? And I thought that was like, oh, okay, well, I'm going to be the kind of character who would like to be in Ravenclaw, but would end up being in Slytherin.
No,
and
then
it's
just
like,
you
okay, you're Ravenclaw because that's what you want. And you're like, oh, I know that that takes your choice into account, but I don't think it actually works. Like you just go up and ask for what you want and you get it. And
yeah,
there's a few things like that where it's like, it asks you how you're going to answer a question and you think it's going to inform your character, and instead it just decides the immediate question. But there are other situations where you say like, oh, I would prefer to be alone actually, and then it informs what kind of character you are.
Yeah, I do have a few criticisms of this game, which is that with some exceptions, the actual gameplay is quite boring because you have a certain amount of energy that regenerates every so often, and when you're like, say you are in a charms lesson learning a new spell, you just click on stuff and use up your energy, and then when you've given enough energy, it's like, oh, now you can do the spell.
Totally. There's like,
not any like, I was expecting there to be like puzzle elements or something
yeah,
to it.
And like, for example, if you're learning a new charm, they'll put a shape in the air that you have to do with your yeah. wand, and I thought it would be like, okay, I'm going to trace over it with my finger, but you can't really get it wrong. Yeah, so it's a bit like, exactly. There's nothing at stake here because I'm just going to get it right by like tapping the screen kind of in any way. And really the whole time I was playing, I was comparing it with the very early Harry Potter games that I used to play on PC. Same. Because
which I love.
They are very similar in a weird way. So in those early games as well, you were playing Harry, but you would go to school in the same way and like get your books and stuff, and then you would like learn a spell and you would have to just like make the shape in the air. But when I was doing that on my like old PC in 2003, I was like click, like it was a little bit harder. Mm. And there were like weird things like these horrible snails that would like kill you. Like there was all this stuff, yeah, that was just like not Harry Potter, but it was quite weirdly imaginative. And even the dialogue, the weird stilted dialogue was very similar. And I'm kind of like, hang on, it's 2018 and we're still really, this is still really the same game as like 2002.
Just a bit worse.
Harry Potter and the Chamber of Secrets. And because it's actually quite a lot for a mobile game, it's really the kind of game you'd expect to play on a computer or a console or something. Mm. And because of that, it needs Wi-Fi for you to play it so that it can download stuff because it's just too much to store in, yeah, a single app. And it's got quite long loading times. So I found myself, yeah, sometimes like losing Wi-Fi for 5 minutes wherever I was and having to like start again and being like, this is really annoying. Or like, yeah, if you want to like play on the toilet in a cafe, like you can't unless you've got Wi-Fi. You can do it on your 3G, but
it would cost you, yeah, money,
I mean, if you've got a great 3G package, then you're fine. But for a lot of people, it won't be that simple. And, yeah, so I kind of felt like, oh, hang on, I'm learning a spell with two clicks and waiting 5 minutes between the next scene. This reminds me of something.
Yeah.
2003.
Yeah. Also, there's just, I really don't like games that are free to download, but then their whole thing is just set up to get money from you. Like, it's designed for you to run out of energy just at the crucial moment so that you'll pay $2.99 to get some more. Yeah. It's like Candy Crush or something, you know, where you have to like pay to get more lives to keep going or wait an annoying amount of time.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, it absolutely doesn't work on me because the actual gameplay is in no way addictive.
Mm. Yeah, I agree. It's just not like high stakes
poking some things
for that.
If it was anything, because I really liked the old Harry Potter PC games when I was playing them back then. And I did used to find it like kind of addictive and like want to see what happened next and all this sort of thing, because there was a puzzle element, there was a like skill thing. Mm. It was good. I just don't feel anything like that with this.
Yeah, same. It doesn't
I find it tedious to like keep clicking on blue outlined shapes.
Yeah.
In order to progress.
Totally. You know? For me, it doesn't compare to the Harry Potter Lego app games, which I think are really good. And they're really addictive, and you know, you can get all the coins and stuff and like that. It's more simplified, and yet it's somehow more engaging. So I would recommend those instead, I think, even though you have to buy them.
Yes. And to be honest, I would rather always pay up front.
Yeah, pay £3 for the game or £5 or whatever more than for the game, like, and then not have to think about it ever again.
And then have it be designed to be a good playing experience rather than a like trap to take your money.
Totally.
So yeah, mixed feelings about Harry Potter Hogwarts Mystery, I think. Mm. But yeah, so for next week, I am going to recommend Anna something, which I actually can't believe we haven't done before, because this is one of my like go-to silly films. And we've done like nearly 150 episodes of this podcast and I still haven't foisted it on you. So finally, now this is the week. And it is the 2001 film Kate and Leopold.
Yeah, this looks batshit.
Which stars Hugh Jackman as a duke from 1876 who accidentally travels forward in time to the present day and falls in love with modern New York woman Meg Ryan.
Of course he does.
There's a lot of very silly stuff in it, but I still find it quite heartwarming. There's quite a lot of it revolves around the Brooklyn Bridge. It's nicely shot.
I actually can't wait. I'm so excited.
Yeah,
I can't believe I've never heard of this film. I'm so excited. My boyfriend's just gone on holiday as well. And like, I need a rom-com to eat with a huge bowl of pasta on my own. And like, this is it. This is perfect.
This is it. You're going to love it. Yeah. There's so many bizarre things in it that even, I mean, I watched it maybe 6 or 7 years after its cinematic release, because I had a friend at university who was obsessed with it. Even then, I was like, what? Wait, why? Yeah. I'm so excited to rewatch it now with my like 2018 brain and find what everything that's wrong with it.
Amazing.
But yes, yeah, so anyway, I hope listeners will join us in enjoying Kate and Leopold. Tune in next week to hear how Anna finds it.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Seriously, the pop culture podcast from The New Statesman.
If you enjoyed the show, why not subscribe to make sure you never miss another episode? We're available in all the usual places you get podcasts, including on Apple Podcasts, where you could leave us a rating and a review if you fancy. It makes us happy and it also helps other people find the show.
If you'd like to come and see us in person, check out the events page of our website, seriouslypod.com/events. Details of our next pop culture quiz and anything else we're doing will appear there.
We're available many other places on the internet, including on Twitter, Facebook and Tumblr. We're Seriously Pod on all of them. Follow us to keep up with what we're up to or to chat to other listeners about things you've enjoyed on the show.
We love getting your recommendations for things we should feature on the show or hearing your thoughts on what we've already discussed. Get in touch on social media or email us on seriouslypod@gmail.com.
And if you feel strongly that more pop culture needs to be taken seriously, spread the word and tell your friends and family about the podcast.